So, the great Zen master Dogen, he was a 13th century Zen master from Japan, who was one of the founders of one of the only two remaining schools of Zen, one of which is Rinzai. He was one of the founders of the Soto school of Zen, which is the school that emphasizes deep zazen, penetrating zazen, shikantaza. And he wrote a definitive text back at that time called the Shobogenzo. And in it was a chapter called Being Time. And in this chapter there's a line that is quite profound. He said, man disposes himself and takes that disposition to be the world. So what does this mean? Seems very simple. So just to take a meta level on this sentence of man disposes himself and takes this disposition to be the world, one could say that man, meaning a human, man or woman, human, it's a man with quotes around it, man takes an action or does something and then fools himself. So Mumon, in a commentary of one of the koans, said that the protagonist of this koan constructed a mask and then scared himself with it. Kind of like that. So what does this mean, man disposes himself? What is to dispose oneself or disposition? It's an interesting word. Disposition we can understand as one's mood or attitude. And to dispose oneself is to take an attitude or to take a position or to assume a certain style. One might say to put on a face to meet the faces that you meet. And when you're in the bathroom, you're indisposed. You're not ready to do that. So man disposes himself. Man takes on an attitude or a mood or feeling and then takes that mood, that attitude, that feeling, that disposition, and sees it as the actual world, the outside world. He sees that disposition to be the world, be the world. Now, a psychology researcher who's actually quite well known and well-respected has a rather novel theory of emotions. I heard this in a podcast I listened to yesterday, actually. And the viewpoint of what you could call feelings, the ordinary viewpoint would be that something makes you feel a certain way. So someone says a hurtful comment to you and it makes you feel sad or hurt. Or I'll give you another example. I'm riding my bike down the street and all of a sudden a car honks its horn and that makes me angry. So in this way, we see the world through our feelings. feelings seem to validate a reality for us, a reality that is so immediate, so profound, so subtle, so intimate, that it almost can't be denied. Now, this researcher had a very unique view on what's actually going on. So she put it this way. She said, we see this set of, you know, maybe several dozen emotions. You can call it fear, anger, hatred, jealousy, you know, you could name them all. There's various gradations and some blending, but there are many of these different emotions, and each seems to be triggered by certain things in the environment or a thought that we might have. But she said, actually, if you study the brain and you look at the brain with functional MRI scanning and you do other types of research, you'll find that what an emotion is as follows. It's very simply one of four things. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, it's a state of arousal or a state of calmness. One of those four, some admixture of the four perhaps. Pleasant, unpleasant, aroused, and calm. And then we do something that turns it into what we experience as an emotion. And how do we do that? So let's go back to this example of my riding my bike. And this, I can tell you this has happened hundreds of times. Riding my bike, and I don't hear it coming, but all of a sudden a car just lays on its horn. Sometimes also will swerve towards me, you know, kind of trying to buzz me off the road. Just a certain kind of hostility that certain people feel when they see other people exercising. Who knows why? And there's almost an instantaneous reaction of anger. And it can be quite intense. It can result in some verbal gesticulations. So what's going on? Well, according to this, according to me, someone honks and I justifiably get angry, pissed off. And this researcher says that there's an unpleasant sensation along with a state of arousal, which is kind of a fight or flight reaction, and then something happens. The computer called the brain, which is a supercomputer, and which does this step extremely quickly because it's learned it over years and years and years, takes this unpleasant sensation and the state of arousal and the context in which it happens and weaves it into an instantaneous story. And the story may be, this asshole driver is trying to hurt me. And they don't deserve to live, you could add that in. And it happens in a finger snap. So what happens is, there's an unpleasant sensation, along with a state of arousal, and then there's a search for a theory of it. The brain searches for a theory, an explanation, a model, a reality, so to speak, with quotes around it. And finding it, it then experiences something that we call an emotion, anger. So in finding this matching theory, I have disposed myself. And in my belief that my disposition was a justifiable reaction to, and in fact was caused by something happening in the so-called outside world, I take my disposition to be the world. You get it? Dogen said, man disposes himself and then takes that disposition to be the world. And if you just stop for a moment, think about that. It has enormous implications. What if part of my theory of things, one of the many ways in which I can snap into a theory of what's happening, is to believe that I am an American? How might that color an instantaneous emotional reaction to an event? See? I don't even have to go into that when you're already getting on the wavelength. What if I was a Christian back in the days of the Inquisition? What if I was a person that adhered to radical Islam, or if I was a Democrat, Republican, a left-winger, Trumpist, as in Trump. You see? One can dispose oneself and then take that disposition to be the world. One makes an action, it's a mental action, and there's a physical component to it which can be measured, and that component is pleasant, unpleasant, aroused, or calm. And then immediately construct a world out there, an outside world, a hard, firm, solid world. Now, the world I construct is not the same as the world you construct or someone else constructs. So then we get these collisions of reality. And that's what brings about all sorts of bad things in the world, oftentimes. And creative things. It's not all bad. So how does that play into what we're doing here and this process which we call Zen practice? And a core aspect of the practice, the very soul, heart, foundation of the practice, which is this activity that one can call Zazen, sitting absorption. What is that? One thing you can say is that it, in a sense, begins to both slow down this instantaneous reflex process of taking a disposition to be the world. It slows it down so you can see what's happening. And then perhaps it even runs it backwards to the origin. You start with the end result and you work back. How do we do that? Well, a core way in which this theory of the world, which is the action part, what your mind has trained itself to do from a very, very young age, by learning about the world, learning about what's right and what's wrong, what you like and what you don't like, what people should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, what they should be believing, what they shouldn't be believing. And this is trained and beat into you. First, perhaps, by your parents, then your friends, then your teachers, then propaganda and advertising and internet, and da-da-da-da-da, and all your life experiences. So that you can very, very quickly, this supercomputer, your brain, can instantaneously make a theory of what's happening and then project it onto the world so that it looks outside, existing, meaning standing outside, solid and true. And in our practice here of Zazen, we can start with a conclusion and then work backwards. How do you do that? The conclusion is actually a construction of sensations and thoughts. Now, in Buddhism, thought actually is a sensation. Thought is a sensation. So you have the ordinary five senses of sight, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And then the sixth sense is thinking. Because the brain, the sense organ of thinking, before any particularities of thinking arise, knows that thinking's happening. It's like the tongue, just before it knows whether something is salty, sweet, bitter, or sour, knows it's tasting. And the ear, before it figures out that it's hearing Bach versus the Rolling Stones, knows that some sound is occurring, right? There's a sensation. First, the sensation. I'm going to call it the first nen, thought, action. It's the immediate moment of contact before any context is applied, so that something becomes named, placed in a category, and then we either like it or don't like it, reject it or cling to it, or ignore it, or whatever. So thinking is a sense. So why don't we, in our zazen, just start with the thinking? We can do that. You're sitting there trying to follow your breath or work on mu, and all these thoughts are crowding in. It's just the actions of this theory-producing supercomputer wanting to nail something down so that it can get it out of your way so you can go back to doing what you really, quote, should be doing, which is mu, or breathing. And it gets very sticky and slippery. It's what you would call a slippery slope. You have one thought, then you reflect on that thought with another thought, and then a third thought, and then a millionth thought. All of this happening within the blink of an eye. And you're off and running. And you forget that you're even there at a zazen guy trying to do zazen. So I propose something to you. I propose that you just think it. Think the thought. Think the thought. Feel the sensation. Feel it. You're not a bad person. You didn't do something horrible. You didn't kill anyone. You just thought a thought. Think the thought, right? Think it. Let the thought go. Let it be thought. Let it think itself. But I only ask you to do one thing, because remember now, we're going to work backwards. This is a very strange place we're entering here, this zazen place. We're going to start with a conclusion and work back to the basic ingredient. So we start with the thinking, and I want to keep that thought going. I don't want the thought to stop, because I'm trying to get down to what it actually is made of. It's like this Zen master I said to one of you today. Zen master said, I never allow myself to be cheated by a single thought. He said, I will take that thought and follow it back to the very bitter end, the source. He says, I take this thought and I say, what are you? What are you? Not what do you mean? What are you? I want to see your naked body. It's that kind of attitude. I want to know what you are. And you're a perfect thing for me to focus on at this moment because you arose. It's this kind of attitude of what in Zen is called not being fooled. Not being fooled by the honk of a horn into flipping someone the bird and calling them an effing a-hole. So I look at this thought and I want it to keep going so I can sense its presence using the sense organ of the brain. It senses thinking. So I can feel what thinking feels like, and I get very curious about that. What does thinking feel like? And then I take another step, what Yuan Wu calls a backward step. We'll read a little from Yuan Wu today. I think the thought. I then notice the sensation of thinking. I leave aside the meaning of thinking because that's going in the opposite direction. Remember, we're working backwards. I go to the sensation of thinking, and then I go to something that it's made of. What is sensation made of? What is it made up of? If I were to look at its most fundamental substance, I would say that, number one, sorry to have to use a word, it's intimate. It's felt inside whatever one might say is me or I. And it is. How stupidly simple. Now, when we say something is inside, another way we could say it is that it appears. It isn't just out there. That would be being outside, which is called existing, standing outside, which is one of the things we learn to project onto the world, the theory that things are outside our knowledge and experience. They actually are, in a real sense, outside. But we're working backwards now. We're going back to the source of that and any other thought. So we see that the thought is intimate, and we see that it is. It is inside, meaning it appears. And then we look at that. So first we're looking at the meaning, then we're looking at the sensation of thinking, then we're looking at the fact that it intimately is, that it appears, and we work from there, as Yuan Wu puts it, taking a backwards step. We begin to really simplify things. We go from the 10th or 20th nen, so there's contact with the sensation, and then there's a recognition that I had that sensation, and then that the sensation fits a certain category, and then I have a reaction to that category, and then, oh, I reacted in that way, and then it's a kind of a resonating, rapid fire, nen, 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 nen. And we work back. Work back to even before the first nen. We work back to this intimate is. Let me read to you a koan. We won't go deeply into the koan. Probably not. Although sometimes I've been known to violate my own plans. This is from the Mumenkan, and it's koan number 44. And the title is Basho, who was a great Zen master. Basho and a staff. We've mentioned this before in another Taisho that I gave several months ago, but we're going to just use this to kind of punctuate and exemplify this talk about how emotions are a series of simple things and then a mental step. So the case goes like this. Basho said to the assembled monks, if you, and this is in parentheses, say, if you say you, it's actually the actual Japanese words or Chinese words are, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you do not have a staff, I will take it away from you. It's considered one of the most difficult koan in the Mumenkan. Basho said to several monks, I'll add those words in brackets, if you say you have a staff, I will give you one. If you say you do not have a staff, I will take it away from you. Now, to better understand this, I want to help you in a certain way. You wouldn't normally come up with this, so it's important to know this, but the staff in many koan is a symbol for what we just went through, the steps of going back to this intimate end. Staff is the knowing beyond any doubt of this intimate aim. It's called the staff. Sometimes they're called the great white ox. True nature, Buddha nature, true self, original face. I don't care what you call it. Here it's called a staff. Now there's also the ordinary staff, which is an object perceived by the eye. There's a sensory experience of seeing something. And now this is interesting too. Because let's say that when you were born with congenital cataracts. And you were born perhaps in a country where that couldn't be corrected rather quickly. And eventually, after years of being blind from these cataracts, you had surgery and the cataracts were removed. And then someone held up a staff. Well, I can tell you right now, you will not see a staff. Why? Your eye is in every other way exactly like anyone else's eye now. You've had the cataracts corrected, you've had new lenses put in, or new cornea put on, or whatever it might have been that obstructed your vision, and now your eye is working normally just like everyone else. But your brain did not learn at a critical time how to create the theory of what you're seeing, and you do not see a staff. You may not see anything at all. It's very strange. It's a kind of what they call cortical blindness. So there's an ordinary staff here, what we learn through experience to be a staff. And Basho says to assembled monks, if you say you have a staff, I will give you one. I'll give you this other kind of staff. I'll show you what this staff really is, the substance of the staff, what it actually is. And he says, if you say you do not have a staff, if you've come to the point where you no longer need to remind yourself of what a staff really is, so now you can just pick the staff up and use it, and you're quite proud of that, on some level, because you've achieved a very great thing in the standpoint of being a Zen student, perhaps. He said, I will take it away from you. So I'll read it again. If you say you have a staff, I will give you one. If you say some asshole honked at you, I will show you what really happened, the substance of it. Substance of it. How liberating. Just that. If you say you do not have a staff, you're now immune to the honks and you understand what they really are, I will take that whole idea away from you too, because I'm going to strip you all the way down to your actual experience. No concepts. No smell of Zen. No attitude of Zen. No acting awakened. No making a distinction between yourself and anyone else. This is what you really need to be. Return to that point before you were able to instantly and reflexively make a theory of everything as a snap judgment. So, the commentary goes like this. It helps you cross the river when the bridge is broken down. Think about how a staff does help you cross the river. But it helps you cross the river when the bridge is broken down. It accompanies you when you return to the village on a moonless night. It shouts out at a driver honking a horn, hey, why'd you honk at me? But if you call it a staff, you will go to hell swifter than an arrow. This is urging us to go back, back, back. Don't stop on the thinking, meaning level, the naming, the categorizing. Go back. Back to the essence, what it originally is, its actuality. That's what this koan is about. So we're going to finish today with someone who is so wonderful, so eloquent. I return to this book many, many times. My teacher, Richard Clark, used to really love this book as well. Particularly later in his teaching days, he would often read and comment from various parts of this book called Zen Letters, Teachings of Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu in Japanese is Engo, and Engo was one of the people that put together the Hekigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record, what is considered to be the most profound and most famous and greatest book of Zen koan. And he wrote the commentaries and other aspects of every koan in the Hekigan Roku, all 100 koan. But I'm going to read this now. So remember what we said about how man disposes himself and takes that disposition to be the world. And that in this process, we start with the world and we work back to something fundamental. Fundamental. So I'll just read a little bit of this chapter before we end. He says, when your vision penetrates through and your use of it is clear, remember the staff that is this original face, you are spontaneously able to turn without freezing up or get stuck amid all kinds of lightning-fast changes and complex interactions and interlocking intricacies. Now, the amazing thing is this was written hundreds and hundreds of years ago. This is before this psychologist did her research, before we knew an awful lot about how the human mind works, the brain works. You're spontaneously able to turn without freezing up or getting stuck amid all kinds of lightning-fast changes and complex interactions and interlocking intricacies, the so-called human condition. You do not establish any views or keep to any mental states. You move with a mighty flow so that, quote, when the wind moves, the grasses bend down. When you enter into enlightenment right where you are, here and now, you penetrate to the profoundest source. You cultivate this realization. Remember what I said about taking this backward step. You come down to the intimate amness of a sensation, not its meaning, the opposite direction. Something very fundamental. And he said, you cultivate this realization till you attain freedom of mind, harboring nothing in your heart. Here, there is no, quote, understanding to be found, much less, quote, not understanding. You go on like this 24 hours a day, unfettered, free from all bonds. Since from the first, you do not keep to subject and object or self and others. All these theories of the world that the supercomputer immediately can do. How could there be any Buddha Dharma, even something that lofty? This is the realm of no mind, no contrived activity, and no concerns. How can this be judged with mere worldly intelligence and knowledge and discrimination and learning if the fundamental basis is lacking? So I think we're going to end there today. His words are so wonderful and so eloquent. And at the risk of explaining too much, we'll just leave it there.